Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 274 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. In this series, I'll be going over a bunch of high-yield vignettes that relate to commonly tested things on the USMLEs. And I'll also spend some time describing the mechanisms behind atelectasis, because that's something that has started popping up quite a bit on exams, and it's just something that is really not described in many resources. And this should be a rapid review series number 45. So let's get going. So what if they give you a question about a 25-year-old male, and they tell you that he's an immigrant, that he recently immigrated to the United States about a year ago, and that, you know, over the last 9 or so months, he's been having like cyclical abdominal pain. And then they tell you something about him having like just constant fatigue. And then they tell you that, oh, a fecal occult blood test is positive. What should you be thinking about? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking that that person potentially has like some worm infection, right? So typically what they will do on your test is they will give you that the person has a very high eosinophil count, right? So you see a lot of eosinophilia. That tells you you're dealing with a worm infection, right? And then they may even give you like a CBC. And you'd notice that, wow, this person's hemoglobin is like 9 and the MCV is like somewhere in the 60s, right, or 70s, telling you that, oh, this is a microcytic anemia of some sort. I would hope in those circumstances that you are thinking about iron deficiency anemia, right? So this person, so if you see a person with iron deficiency anemia and has eosinophilia, then you want to be thinking about some kind of GI bleed from a worm infection, right? So what are those worms, right? I would, you know, for the most part, it's going to be a hookworm infection. So it can be something like Necator or Ancelostoma. So those things, they basically suck blood literally from you. So you're chronically losing blood, right? It's almost like menstruating through the GI tract. If that happens, right, you're going to become iron deficient. And remember, when a person has iron deficiency anemia, the first thing you're going to notice is their iron stores will be depleted, right? So their ferritin will be low. And then, in addition to the ferritin being low, if the body is like, wow, I don't have iron stores, well, your body is going to send out all its little foot soldiers to try to corral iron from anywhere possible. So your TIBC is going to go up, right? And then your transferrin is not going to be very saturated because you literally have no iron, right? So your transferrin saturation is going to be diminished. So if you see a person that has a microcytic anemia in the presence of a parasitic infection, then you want to think about a hookworm infection of some sort with, again, Necator or Ancelostoma. But if they give you a question about a person that has an anemia and it's macrocytic and they have a parasitic infection, then I want you to think about Diphyllobothrium ladder. Remember, that's that bug that loves to consume B12. It's one of those bugs that can cause a B12 deficiency. And B12 deficiency obviously does not cause a microcytic anemia. On MBM exams, it causes a macrocytic. If you want to be more specific, it's going to be a megaloblastic anemia. And remember, when people have a B12 deficiency, their homocysteine levels is going to be very high, right? But then in addition to that, they're going to have an increase in their methylmalonic acid levels. They're going to have a methylmalonic acidemia as a result of that. And many of these worm infections, especially the hookworm infections, you can treat them with bendazole. So like albendazole, mebendazole, thiabendazole, things like that. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this is a 26-year-old male, has a history of FSGS, and that he had a renal transplant like 3 weeks ago. And then they notice that since he got that renal transplant, his creatinine for over the past week or something, let's say he's been going for regular checkups, his creatinine has jumped from like 1.5 to 3.7. And they tell you that he has been having like skin hyperpigmentation and all those things. What should you be thinking about? And they tell you that he's on a bunch of immunosuppressants. So they give you like a ton of immunosuppressants, and then you have to figure out which one is causing the problem. Well, what should you be thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking about cyclosporine. Remember, cyclosporine is kind of a weird thing. It loves to cause kidney problems, right? So that's why whenever, this is actually a high yield concept to know. Whenever a person is having a transplant problem, especially if it's a kidney transplant, they love to do this because they know people will find it hard to tease apart. Whenever you see a person that has like a transplant problem and the transplanted organ doesn't seem to be working well, you need to biopsy that transplant. You need to biopsy that transplant because without biopsying that transplant, you can't see for sure what's going on. You can't see for sure if it's the immunosuppressant that's causing problems or if it's the transplanted organ that actually has problems. So you always need to take some kind of biopsy. So in this case, especially for the person where they got a renal transplant 3 weeks ago, so you're wondering, is this acute rejection or is this cyclosporine toxicity? So you need biopsy results to be able to make those claims, right? Because cyclosporine tends to cause problems with the afferent arterial. It causes a constriction of the afferent arterial. And remember, cyclosporine toxicity is not just nuking the kidneys. It can also do other stuff, right? Like it can cause gingival hyperplasia. So the person's gingiva gets really big. So if you see a person where it's like, man, this person's gingiva is like way bigger than the person's teeth, then you want to think about cyclosporine toxicity. And then it can also cause skin hyperpigmentation and like hirsutism. So those are all things you should come to associate with cyclosporine on an MBM exam. In terms of some of these other immunosuppressants and their classic side effects, right? So don't forget like Miromonab. Miromonab, sometimes you may see it on exams referred to as OKT3. Remember, it's basically something that attacks the CD3 receptor that we find on T cells. The thing about Miromonab is the first time you get it, that first attack of the CD3 receptor may actually cause like a cytokine storm. So it's almost like a first dose effect. Whenever a drug has a first dose effect, your friends at the NBME love to test those, right? So you can get a first dose effect with Miromonab because, again, ultimately, it will knock down your T-cell population. It will take CD3 out of circulation. But that first attack may not be as pleasant. Your T-cells may think it's some kind of stimulation. And then you release a lot of cytokines that can cause a really bad like febrile-like reaction, like a septic-like reaction. But after a while, it kind of goes away. So usually when you start people on Miromonab, it's probably not the worst idea in the world to maybe keep them in the hospital for like a day or two, watch them, make sure they're doing well before you send them home. And then don't forget cyclophosphamide, right? It's also used as an immunosuppressant. Cyclophosphamide loves to torch people's bladders. Big, big, big thing with cyclophosphamide is the bladder, right? Likes to cause hemorrhagic cystitis. So it can be a person on immunosuppressive therapy, having a lot of blood clots, like fresh blood in your urine. You want to think about hemorrhagic cystitis. They'll have like lower abdominal pain because obviously that's where your bladder is. And remember, you can prevent that by giving Mesna. Mesna binds up the acrolein, which is a metabolite of cyclophosphamide that causes all those problems. But another thing that they love to test on MBME exams, because they know most people have memorized this Mesna business. One thing you should maybe keep at the back of your mind is this whole concept of hydration. So people that take cyclophosphamide, they actually get a lot of, especially when they're studying it newly, they tend to get a ton of IV fluid hydration. They tend to get a lot of bladder irrigation. So you're literally like squirting water into these people's bladders so that the acrolein does not attach to the bladder epithelium for too long. And then don't forget that cyclophosphamide is also a risk factor for bladder cancer. It's also a risk factor for bladder cancer. And then don't forget azathioprine. That's another classically used immunosuppressant. The big thing with azathioprine is if you have gout, you better know what you're doing. At least usually when people have gout and they're taking allopurinol or febuxostat, those xanthine oxidase inhibitors, typically what is done is you're going to give a much lower dose of 6-mecarthopurine or its derivative, azathioprine. Because remember, those drugs, those immunosuppressants, are broken down by xanthine oxidase. So if you're thinking of xanthine oxidase inhibitor, those drugs can increase in amount, they can increase in quantity, they can hang around for longer, and you can begin to see a lot of toxicity. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient, and they tell you that this patient was recently started on chemotherapy for some hematologic malignancy? And then the patient has been having a lot of epistaxis, a lot of bleeding gums, and they then show you some labs and you notice that the patient's bleeding time is increased and the PT and PTT are both increased and the patient has like some weird liver lab abnormalities, like the AST, ALT is a little elevated. If you see this, I would hope you're thinking about acute promyelocytic leukemia. Remember, acute promyelocytic leukemia, that's the one that's associated with the 15-17 translocation where you have those hour rods. Those hour rods can trigger DIC. So if you see DIC in the setting of treatment for some kind of hematologic malignancy, I want you to absolutely think about acute promyelocytic leukemia. Now, how do we treat acute promyelocytic leukemia? Well, we use all trans retinoic acid, right? But again, your friends at the NBME, they're smart. They probably won't put Atra. Again, Atra is plastered over every Anki deck known to man. So they may put retinoic acid derivative, they may put vitamin A derivative as an answer choice. So for acute promyelocytic leukemia, you give those people all trans retinoic acid. Well, why does that help? The thing is, because acute promyelocytic leukemia is an acute leukemia, it's a blast cell problem. So because it's a blast cell problem, if you can give those blast cells something that will cause them a work on the genetic level, right? Remember, all trans retinoic acid, it binds to an intracellular receptor that goes and binds to, you know, it dimerizes, and then you bind to a response element on DNA. All those things, when it smashes that receptor, that response element on DNA, it will then cause those blast cells to differentiate towards a terminal cell. Because blast cells, they have the ability to divide. That's why acute leukemias are bad, right? But it basically takes you from like some cell that, oh, can divide, to some cell that cannot divide. Well, if you differentiate a cell to a cell that cannot divide, well, guess what? That cancer is pretty much cured, right? Because those terminal cells, they can't live forever. They will die after a while. And then the cancer goes away. The cancer goes away. Now, next thing I want to talk about here, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient has a history of scleroderma, like crest scleroderma? So they give you all the findings, you know, the calcinosis. They tell you when the person goes out in the cold, the fingers turn blue, they become cyanotic. And then they tell you that over the last 6 months, this patient has been having profound shortness of breath, having a lot of exercise intolerance. And then they tell you that they give you like this stack of numbers, especially for the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart. And you notice that, man, this person's right ventricular pressures are really, really high. What should you be thinking about in those circumstances? I would really hope that you're thinking about the person having pulmonary arterial hypertension. Remember, people that have crest scleroderma, they can get pulmonary hypertension. In fact, that's one of the most common causes of death in scleroderma. So those people, they can get pulmonary arterial hypertension. But you want to be careful about the differences between the pulmonary arterial hypertension in people with crest scleroderma versus people that have the diffuse cutaneous systemic sclerosis. So people that have crest scleroderma, their pulmonary hypertension is a pulmonary arterial hypertension. Their lungs are, for the most part, fine, but their pulmonary arteries are not. So that fibrosis and all that badness, collagen deposition happens in their pulmonary arteries. So because they have a pulmonary arterial hypertension, then they go into right-sided heart failure, and then they get into trouble. People that have the diffuse sclerosis, the thing that happens with them is they have interstitial lung disease. They have interstitial lung disease, and then that interstitial lung disease would then ultimately give rise to a pulmonary hypertension. So they're essentially going into right heart failure because their actual lung parenchyma is all messed up. So they may put corpulmonale as an answer. Basically, whenever you see a person having pulmonary hypertension or right-sided heart failure because of a lung process, then the right answer you should be picking as the cause of their problem or their shortness of breath or whatever is going to be corpulmonale. Corpulmonale is what happens. That's the mechanism behind the right-sided heart failure, for example, in a person that has COPD. Although don't forget that primary pulmonary hypertension is something that happens when you have, it will be like in a young female and she'll be having shortness of breath and she'll have very elevated, they'll tell you about like, oh, this floats some kind of Swan-Ganz catheter and her right-sided heart pressures are really high, her pulmonary arterial pressures are really high. If you see that, right, you definitely want to think about primary pulmonary hypertension from that BMPR2 mutation, right? I think it's like the bone morphogenic protein receptor 2 mutation. And remember, for those people that have this primary arterial pulmonary hypertension, you can try to give them pulmonary vasodilators, right? So you want to give them something like a phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor, so something like sildenafil, vardenafil, or you can give them like a prostaglandin analog, right? So something like epoprostenol or like iloprost. Or you can also give them an endothelin receptor antagonist, so something like ambrisentan or bosentan. Those things can help in those circumstances. Now, let me take a small segue and describe and I'll be done with this podcast soon since it's a rapid review podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and describe some of these mechanisms behind atelectasis, because one thing the NBME is doing these days is they will give you a question about a person that has atelectasis, and then they will give you like many different answers where you're like, man, they ask like, which is the most likely mechanism behind this patient's presentation, right? And then they'll put many different things, right? So let's go through some of these mechanisms, because literally they put answer choices where it's literally the mechanism that they are putting as an answer. And then people are like, oh, what do I do in these circumstances, right? So what do you do with these? The first thing you want to recognize is you want to recognize that the different kinds of atelectasis, right? So like the first one, you may put an answer that says resorptive atelectasis. Another name for resorptive atelectasis is actually obstructive atelectasis. So what's the mechanism? Why does the lung collapse in this circumstance? The reason the lung collapses is, first things first, you're going to completely occlude an airway. So say, for example, a person, let's say like in a kid, it can be like a foreign body in ingestion problem, right? Or it can be a person that has a really bad mucus plug, let's say because they have asthma or because they've been on a ventilator. So the thing is, whenever you completely obstruct an airway, then basically the portion of lung that is supplied by that airway does not get any oxygen, right? Now, whatever air is in that part of lung before the obstruction, well, remember there are pulmonary capillaries going all around the lungs. So the blood that's flowing through those pulmonary capillaries is going to pick up a lot of that air. It's going to pick up a lot of that oxygen. So as you're picking up that air, and there's no air coming in to replenish it, then obviously that part of lung is going to collapse. That is resorptive atelectasis, right? That is resorptive atelectasis. And classically on MBM exams, if you see like, you know, a patient coming outpatient basis, let's say like an older male or older female smoker, and they have, you notice that, man, this person, you get a chest x-ray, you notice that one complete lung has collapsed or one complete lung lobe has collapsed. Oh, that's not good. You need to send them for a CT scan because they likely have some kind of lung cancer that's obstructing like a bronchus or something like that. That's actually a pretty classic, not just on MBMs, but also in real life. If I'm taking care of a patient and the patient has like big time atelectasis of one lung lobe and you're like an older person, I'm not going to think twice about getting a chest CT because they likely have lung cancer. Now, another classic mechanism behind atelectasis that shows up on exams is this whole concept of relaxation atelectasis. Sometimes it's called passive atelectasis. This is something that you classically see whenever there's something between like your visceral pleura and your parietal pleura. Remember, the visceral pleura is the part that is juxtaposed to the lung itself. And then the parietal pleura is the one that's juxtaposed to the chest wall. So the thing is, if there is something that comes between those two bodies, right? So let's say like fluid, let's say a person has a really bad pleural effusion, or air, like a person has a really bad pneumothorax. Well, that thing can basically rip apart the visceral and parietal pleura. And then the visceral pleura will just basically like keep pressing on the lung parenchyma. And the person will have an atelectasis. The lung will collapse in those circumstances. Another classic one you may also see is something called compressive atelectasis, right? Compressive atelectasis. Usually this happens when you have some kind of lesion, right? So let's say a person has like an adenocarcinoma, like a big mass or a large cell carcinoma of the lungs that's kind of growing in the periphery. Well, the thing that can do is it's literally a mass. Well, that mass is growing. If someone is growing, that means someone else is going to be shrinking, right? So the thing that's going to be shrinking is the structure that has less density. In this case, there's going to be a lung with the air in it, right? So that mass can literally physically compress on the lung parenchyma, and then the person ultimately gets in trouble. So those are kind of like the three big ones I will say you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. They love to test these things. It's just one of these things, again, you won't see discussed in many places, but it's something that you want to make sure you know and you understand. Okay, so I'm trying to think, do I want to cover a new topic now? Okay, let's cover one more topic. I just want to try to keep this under 20 minutes since it's a rapid review. Okay, let's talk about one more mechanism actually. So a classic thing you'll hear, you'll read about in many OB-GYN texts, right? Or you'll see on many OB-GYN exams, or you see many OB-GYN resources, is how having some kind of infection during pregnancy, right? So like pyelonephritis or asymptomatic bacteriuria or, you know, bacterial vaginosis or whatever, they'll tell you that, man, this thing increases the patient's risk for XYZ, right? And usually it increases the patient's risk for preterm labor and delivery. So I know some of you may be wondering, okay, well, why is that the case? Why will the risk of preterm labor and delivery be increased when a person has an infection? Well, think about it. When you have an infection in pregnancy, right, that brings an inflammatory state to the body. Well, when you have inflammation, well, the things that will be produced will be things like leukotrienes and things like prostaglandins. If you remember, prostaglandins, they are very powerful contractors of the uterus, right? They can induce the myometrium to begin to contract. So when you have those inflammatory states, those prostaglandins that are released can cause the uterus to begin to contract and can take that woman into preterm labor, right? So she begins to have like uterine contractions. So that's really the mechanism. That's really the mechanism behind all those things. And then another thing, that's why you want to be quite aggressive with the treatment of infections a woman has during pregnancy. Another mechanistic thing that helps with understanding is, some people may say, okay, why do fetuses have variable D cells when the umbilical cord is compressed? I believe I may have described it in another podcast, but if I've not, I'll go ahead and describe it right now. So the thing that happens is, when you compress the umbilical cord, you are literally squishing on the umbilical blood vessels. And when you squish on the umbilical blood vessels, what do you think that's going to do to the child's blood pressure? That's going to raise the child's blood pressure. And remember, fetuses have baroreceptors as well. So the baroreceptors around their carotids and things like that will sense, oh, blood pressure is really, really high. And since the blood pressure is really, really high from that compression, because again, fetuses, those umbilical blood vessels are probably the biggest blood vessels that exist in said fetus. So you squish on those, you raise the blood pressure, baroreceptors start freaking out. So the body responds by sending out the parasympathetic discharge. And that parasympathetic discharge can slow conduction down the AV node. If you slow conduction down the AV node, that's going to cause a bradycardia. That's what manifests as a deceleration on the fetal heart rate monitor. So those are things that I think are important mechanisms to understand, especially in the context of some NBME questions I've seen relatively recently. So thank you for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast. I have this on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify. And then I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And then if you want to get like an alert when I make a new podcast or upload a new podcast, just feel free to go ahead and subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. So I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I wish you all the best with your ERA cycle. God bless you. Thank you.